Storm clouds gathering along the Texas coast as a tropical depression bears down on the Lone Star State. A closer look at the potential impact today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio, with support from Rand Group. Software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm David Brown. More on the weather situation and what South Texas should be prepared for this weekend. Also, as schools scramble to assemble reopening plans, high school football teams prepare to return to the field. We'll have the latest. Also, a Cybertruck factory cruises into Texas, the 30th anniversary of the Americans with Disabilities Act, the week in politics with the Texas Tribune, and a whole lot more when the Texas Standard gets underway right after this. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard time on this 24th day of July. I'm David Brown. Great to have you with us. As we come to you this Friday, there are a lot of Texans scrambling trying to figure out what's next. Yesterday, we learned that nearly 3 million Texans have filed for unemployment since the start of this pandemic in March. And soon, more than half of those folks, 1.6 million Texans, will be losing an important benefit that has helped tide them over. That $600 weekly boost made possible through the CARES Act. Though the payments are supposed to expire nationally on the 31st because of a technicality in state law that prevents the payment of benefits for partial weeks, the benefit expires tomorrow here in Texas. That'll leave Texans getting anywhere from $69 to $521 per week in unemployment benefits unless Congress retroactively extends the benefit, and so a lot could hang on just a few words in the legislation, assuming there is legislation and that more relief is forthcoming. At the moment, with a brawl over what to do brewing on Capitol Hill, it's not likely there'll be any new plan until early next week at the earliest. Speaking of storm clouds, there are literal ones massing along the Texas Gulf Coast right now. And Texans in that part of the state have their eyes on the skies. There's a tropical storm watch along the upper Gulf Coast and a tropical storm warning stretching from the west end of Galveston Island all the way to Port Mansfield in South Texas, which includes several counties further inland, too. Eric Berger is a meteorologist who has covered this region for some time. He's with Houston-based Space City Weather, and he joins us now. Eric, welcome back to the Texas Standard.
Thank you, David.
Tropical Depression 8 formed into Tropical Storm Hanna overnight. What's known about this storm and what kind of punch it'll pack?
Well, it's a tropical storm, and we've been waiting to see if it's going to get organized out over the Gulf. It now has, and with that, it's got smooth sailing in terms of wind shear and other factors as it approaches the Texas coast over about the next 24 hours. So we expect it to further strengthen some in terms of wind speed, but still the biggest concern with these kinds of tropical storms generally is rainfall, and that's definitely the case with Hanna.
I guess one of the big concerns is whether or not a storm like this is liable to stall, but with the kind of momentum that it's been building up, is that likely?
No, fortunately, the steering currents for Hanna are pretty good. It should continue to push it westward and then maybe a turn toward the southwest eventually. But it's not going to stall out like we've seen with some systems in the past that have really dumped, you know, dozens and dozens of inches of rain on Texas.
Yeah, when you start talking about these storms that develop in the Gulf, I think at least of late, everyone fears Harvey. A lot of people were not expecting it to dump as much rain as it did and to just hang out as long as it did. But let's talk about the timeline if we can. Do you have a sense of when and where this storm will make landfall along the Texas Gulf Coast and who should be battening the hatches right now?
Yeah, it's increasingly likely that the storm is going to come in maybe 50 miles, give or take, south of Corpus Christi. And so that's going to put some fairly strong winds over that area. I would think sustained winds, we may see 50 miles per hour, maybe up to 60 in a few locations. So pretty nasty right along the coast, but the wind should die off pretty quickly as the storm moves inland. The big concern, as we talked about, is rainfall. You know, the models aren't overly aggressive, but it certainly seems possible that some locations, you know, down there could see 10 or more inches of rain over the next 2 to 3 days. And areas in the Rio Grande Valley, certainly that can cause flooding pretty quickly. So I'm a little bit concerned about that as the storm pushes through.
And when you say flooding, you're talking about flash flooding, right?
Yeah, exactly. You know, the thing about tropical rainfall is that it produces really high rainfall rates. And so you can see, you know, 3, 4, 5 inches per hour. And that backs up streets, you know, almost immediately and pushes into yards and can push into structures. And so, you know, when we talk about a rainstorm in the winter, it doesn't have these high rainfall rates. But when you get a system like this pushing in, bringing all that Gulf moisture, it just dumps it out.
What about Houston, folks in the biggest city in Texas? Should they be too concerned about this storm?
No, we really dialed back our expectations yesterday for the storm. Basically, it's going to be a wet and gray weekend in Houston. If you live along the coast, you're going to notice, you know, a rise in tides a couple feet. Winds may pick up a little bit, but inland, you know, we're probably not going to see winds above 20 miles per hour. And for the most of the area, it looks like 1 to 3 inches of rain, which is more than manageable. So it's not a good weekend to be outside. Probably we're in the middle of a pandemic, so you know how it goes.
Well, speaking of, I mean, you got people who will be in the path of this storm in the valley, and they're also dealing with a pandemic. What do they do? Do you have any advice for them?
Well, with a storm like this, it's best anywhere where you are in Texas to ride it out. It's not a hurricane pushing a huge storm surge. We don't expect to see winds that are going to damage structures. And so it's really best to sort of stay home during an event like this. You know, the bigger concern is as we get deeper into the season, we see a larger and a more powerful hurricane that forces an evacuation. And in the middle of a pandemic, that could truly be a nightmare.
Eric, you've been covering these for years. How does this tropical depression fit when it comes to the calendar, when it comes to years past, what it might say about hurricane season? Does it say anything for hurricane season?
Not really. I mean, this is kind of a typical July tropical system we get in the Gulf of Mexico. It's probably not going to quite reach hurricane strength, though we do expect it to intensify. The hurricanes we typically see come in August and September. The notable thing about this year is that there have been a lot of these storms. We're already up to the H storm. That's the earliest than ever before. And looking out over the next several weeks, it does look like the Atlantic tropics are going to be quite active. And it's a little early to see these big storms moving across the Atlantic. But I think that that's where we're going to start to see as we get into next week.
Eric Berger is editor and meteorologist for Houston-based Space City Weather. Eric, thanks again.
My pleasure.
As schools figure out their plans for the fall semester, one related question is what happens with sports. States like California, Washington, and New Mexico have moved fall sports to the spring, but in Texas, where Friday night lights in the fall are for football, public schools are going to give athletics a go. The Texas Standard's Michael Marks has more.
This is a big season for the Fulshear High School volleyball team. The Chargers won the school's first state championship last year, and they've got a lot of experienced players returning. But as coronavirus cases in Texas rose and fell, then rose again, it became less and less clear whether they'd get a chance to defend their title.
That's just been my biggest concern around all this is, you know, worried about my seniors not having their senior season, and to not have that would have just been devastating.
That's the team's head coach, Sydney Gocher. She breathed a sigh of relief earlier this week when the University Interscholastic League, or UIL, announced its plan for the fall. Sports and activities like marching band got the go-ahead. Schools in the four smallest divisions can start on August 3rd. Schools in the two biggest divisions can begin 1 month later. The idea is that since bigger schools tend to be in densely populated areas with more coronavirus cases, the delay will give some time for the spread to slow down. Jamie Harrison is the deputy director of the UIL.
Given all of the challenges, the variety of ways that COVID-19 is impacting different communities across Texas, this is the best solution we could develop based on what we know today.
Harrison said that the UIL is nowhere close to canceling fall sports and would only do so as a last resort. But schools can choose to opt out. It's a decision that athletic directors like Cheryl Fillmore are grappling with.
I guess the thing that I'm most concerned with is the fear that this disease, this terrible disease, could affect our community. And so with that, it's like, is it really safe to allow our kids to come back?
Fillmore is the AD at West Oso High School in Corpus Christi. The district's schools will open on August 24th, and the first few weeks will mostly be online. but the school's volleyball and football teams can start practicing well before that under the guidelines.
Being that there's not face-to-face instruction, if they can't do that, is it really safe for them to come back to the athletic arena? We have a concern about that.
Schools are required to follow certain social distancing guidelines. Players must wear a face covering at all times unless they're playing or doing a drill. Stadiums and gyms will be limited to half their capacity of spectators. Anyone who shows any signs of the coronavirus must be symptom-free for 3 days before coming back to school. Gocher, the volleyball coach at Fulcher, plans to film practices to identify who is near each other in case a player or coach gets the virus. Coaches realize that even if they play by the book, there's no guarantee that they'll get a whole season, but there's at least an opportunity.
You know, I think if we're following the rules like we should, and we will as coaches, I think there's a reasonable chance we're going to be able to navigate our way through this.
That's Rodney Webb, president of the Texas High School Coaches Association and the head coach of the Denton-Geyer High School football team. As things currently stand, he doesn't see calling off or delaying the season as an option.
You know, a lot of people say, oh, there's a football coach talking. He just wants to get his football fix in. Our kids need this diversion. Our schools need it. Our communities need it. It is woven into the fabric of our society. Those Friday nights are a microcosm of all that's good in our society.
The question that parents, principals, and superintendents have to answer is whether the good that comes out of those Friday nights is worth the risk that comes with them. For the Texas Standard, I'm Michael Marks.
Our social media editor is Wells Dunbar, and he's monitoring what Texans are talking about online. Hello there, Wells.
Hello, David. As we've been hearing, Tropical Storm Hanna and the weather watches and warnings abounding along the Gulf Coast, the talk of Texas. In the central Texas region, Vicki Stockton-Smith notes that she's out of the direct path of the storm, but that might provide some direct, much-needed relief in the form of rain as central Texas nears drought conditions. Meanwhile, closer to the coast, Elizabeth French says hopefully the rains from TS Tropical Storm Hanna don't flood southeast Texas. And Carla Herring, Boysen Venue, says that she's on her back porch in lovely Padre Island watching the tide rise up in her canal and thinking of her inland friends. And of course, as we heard, Corpus Christi and the Rio Grande Valley, two hard-hit COVID-19 hotspots, bracing to get some impact from that as well. Seen remarks on social media about having to pack potential pandemic supplies away with other things you'll need to ride out a storm. Just one of the stories we're hearing about, David. I'll be back with more later in the show.
One of many. Let us know what's on your news radar, Texas. Reach out to us at Texas Standard on your social media platform of choice. Wells Dunbar looking for you. He'll be back in 35.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas ABLE program, a tax advantage savings program helping eligible Texans with disabilities save for the future. Learn more, including how the program works with certain public benefits, at texasable.org.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. The Trump administration has been detaining migrant children and adults in hotels and then quickly expelling them to their home countries. The Associated Press reports the Hampton Inn in McAllen is one of those hotels. Texas Public Radio's Dominic Anthony Walsh went to that hotel, where an attorney was denied access to the migrants on Thursday.
Video shows Texas Civil Rights Project attorney Andrew Udelsman attempting to access the fourth floor of the Hampton Inn Hotel in McAllen.
Can we see your badges, sir?
A group of men ask for his badge.
Can I ask who you are?
Can I ask who you are, sir?
They refuse to identify themselves and shove him into an elevator.
Get out now!
Udelsman says they're contractors with MVM Incorporated. In an email response to TPR inquiries, MVM confirmed that it has a contract with Immigration and Customs Enforcement, but referred requests for comment to ICE. TCRP took to Twitter, and a small group of people gathered. At least three people, including a small child, could be seen waving at a window on the fourth floor. Udelsman says this is part of a pattern of Customs and Border Protection and ICE holding immigrants at hotels without legal representation before expelling them.
This is completely illegal. They're violating domestic and international law, and they're committing grave abuses against these children.
ICE, CBP, and Hampton by Hilton did not immediately respond to requests for comment. Since late March, the Trump administration has implemented an order that quickly expels migrants without hearings, effectively ending the asylum process under the pretext of stopping the spread of COVID-19. I'm Dominic Anthony Walsh in McAllen, Texas.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider, proud to be on the job with essential workers who are out there working safe and keeping Texas strong. More at texasmutual.com/onthejob.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. On July 26, 1990, President George H.W. Bush signed the Americans with Disabilities Act. The landmark law turns 30 this Sunday. The ADA barred discrimination against people with disabilities in housing, public accommodation, and employment. It provides protections many people may assume have always been the law of the land, but before the ADA, far more people with disabilities lived in institutional settings, had difficulty or could not enter public places, and had no recourse when denied a job. Lex Fridin was there from the beginning, in fact, before the beginning. He is director of the Independent Living Research Utilization Program at Tier Memorial Hermann Rehabilitation Institute in Houston. He's also been called one of the chief architects of the Americans with Disabilities Act. Professor Fridin, welcome to the Texas Standard.
David, I'm glad to be here with you today.
Tell us a little bit more about life for people with disabilities before the ADA. Could you explain for us a bit about what kinds of physical and institutional barriers were in place before passage of the act?
You know, people who can't remember that far back, or people who weren't yet born, have a hard time imagining how life was. No one with a disability, and certainly not a mobility impairment, a sensory impairment, or a cognitive or intellectual disability, could have free access. I mean, even the sidewalks had barriers. There were no curb ramps. We take that for granted today. If you went to a movie theater in a wheelchair, even if you could get in the theater itself and manage to find yourself a space in the aisle, the fire department would come and move you away because you were a fire hazard. And if you tried to get into a university, you might be told the university has a policy that will not accept people with disabilities.
Well, how did it ultimately come about? Because people with disabilities have been advocating for increased rights for some time. Were there certain individuals or certain events that seemed to break the logjam?
Way back in the 60s, when the veterans began to return from Vietnam with disabilities, mm-hmm. They made it clear that they were not feeling welcome. And then about the same time, people with disabilities obviously were cognizant of the civil rights movement. And finally, people with disabilities in the mid-70s began to organize, and a movement sort of took root. Those kinds of actions in cities across America created a sort of awareness, but it never led to anything until 1986, when a small federal agency called the National Council on Disability mm-hmm. produced a report called Toward Independence. And that report recommended a law like ADA. Vice President Bush took a hold of the report and said he wanted to make it real. 2 years later, he was elected president, and then the Congress got behind the ADA, and it eventually passed, and the president was able to sign it July the 26th, 1990.
Could you maybe bullet point some of the basic elements of the ADA?
Well, the ADA is essentially a non-discrimination law, and it basically says you can't treat people with disabilities, people with impairments, people with physical, sensory, psychiatric, intellectual, people with any type of disability. You must accept that they are equal, and that means removing readily achievable barriers and providing reasonable accommodation. The vision of ADA is full participation by people with disabilities in our economy, in our society, in our schools, in our workplace, and so on.
And I suppose we should point out, too, that the ADA hasn't been static in these 30 years. It has grown and evolved in the way it affects the lives of people, right?
It has. Later in the 1990s, there was a court case in Georgia, and the Supreme Court ruled that the state of Georgia, and for that matter, any other state, had to ensure that people who were fully able to live in the community were supported in the community rather than institution. And that was a real landmark decision based on the Americans with Disabilities Act. Right now, there's an outstanding issue related to the internet. People who have certain issues navigating websites or hearing or seeing material that is streaming are left out of the virtual world.
Do you recall the day that the ADA was signed and your feelings on that day?
Actually, I recall the night before the ADA was signed. I had a distant cousin who was a producer at CNN, and he invited me to the CNN studios in Washington. And serendipitously, I was there when the CNN news director in Washington was online with the CNN news director in Atlanta, determining what the program would be for the next morning. The CNN director said, "We'll cover the ADA signing tomorrow morning in little short broadcasts, maybe a little clip once an hour." But he said, "We're not going to take the whole network off the air and direct it to the White House for a 30-minute or an hour-long signing ceremony." And I said, "Please give that some thought, because this will affect people all over the country and, frankly, all over the world." That signing ceremony was carried around the world. It was front-page news in every newspaper in the United States. And I think at that point in time, we probably educated and made more people aware of the abilities of people with disabilities and the discrimination they faced in the process of trying to be full participants. It was a wonderful, wonderful experience and a great day.
Lex Fridin is professor of health informatics at the University of Texas Health Science Center in Houston. He's a former chairman of the National Council on Disability, and this weekend he will participate in ADA 30, an online celebration of the 30th anniversary of the Americans with Disabilities Act. We'll have a link to the full program over at texasstandard.org, including more information on the ADA. Professor Fridin, thanks so much for taking time to speak with us on the Texas Standard.
Dave, thanks so much for having me.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. As millions of Texans struggle to afford rent amid the coronavirus pandemic, some are about to take another financial hit. The $600 weekly addition to unemployment insurance Congress provided through the CARES Act ends tomorrow. Eric Samuels, who heads Texas Homeless Network, says the benefits should be extended.
Continuing this bonus is, I think, something that's vital, and it's something that without, we're going to end up paying much, much more in the end. It's much more expensive to allow someone to fall into homelessness and then try to help them out of homelessness than it is to keep people in housing.
Samuels also wants Congress to pass rental relief and the Texas Supreme Court to again place a moratorium on evictions. He says without such measures, the number of people experiencing homelessness in the state could increase by 40%. Officials in the Corpus Christi area are urging residents not to underestimate the impact of Tropical Storm Hanna, which formed in the Gulf of Mexico Thursday night. But Nueces County Judge Barbara Canales says it's important to prepare, not panic.
I want you to go through your hurricane checklist. I want you to prepare as if it were a bigger storm. It's a great idea to do this. If you had to evacuate, ask yourself, could you? If you had to shelter in place, ask yourself, can I?
In addition to the coastal bend, the upper Rio Grande Valley and the Texas Hill Country may get severe weather this weekend as a result of the storm. Meanwhile, extreme drought conditions in the Texas Panhandle and South Plains are forcing farmers and ranchers to abandon crops and sell off livestock. Earlier this week, the governor issued disaster declarations for 25 counties in the region. That includes Deaf Smith County, where veterinarian Chris Grotegoot raises cattle and grain. He says even crops under intensive irrigation are languishing in the hot, dry weather.
There's certainly cornfields you can walk into that normally would be, you know, 8 or 10 foot tall plants way above your head, the top of the tassel, and you could walk out across the field and your head is above the top of the plants.
The U.S. Drought Monitor reports drought conditions expanded to more than a third of the state in the past week. And the Dallas City Council will consider renaming a street after a black resident killed in his home by a white off-duty police officer. Three council members on Thursday formally requested changing a stretch of South Lamar Street to Botham Jean Boulevard. The road runs alongside the apartment where Jean was murdered and the Dallas Police Department's headquarters. I'm Joseph Leahy for the Texas Standard.
You're listening to statewide news from public radio stations across Texas. This coverage is only possible because of support from listeners like you. You can help sustain and grow Texas news coverage by donating to your local public radio station today.
33 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. It is rare to highlight positive economic news these days, and of course, positive is always in the eye of the beholder. But Austin area leaders are certainly celebrating the news this week that electric vehicle company Tesla will build a $1 billion factory just east of town. The company secured some tax incentives before making the deal and promises to make available a minimum number of permanent full-time jobs and an average salary of at least $47,000 for plant workers. With more on the details here, we turn to Jimmy Moss. He's a reporter at our home station, KUT in Austin. Jimmy, how are you?
I am good. How are you?
I am fine. Thank you very much. Sounds like Austin's doing pretty well with this deal from Tesla. Of course, there are some catches here and some pretty big ones. First, let's go back. Remind us why CEO Elon Musk was looking for a new plant site in the first place.
Well, he has been looking for a plant site for a little bit. This would be the fifth gigafactory in his portfolio. He did throw out the possibility that he might move his headquarters from Fremont, California, after the plant was closed down by the California stay-at-home orders, and he threatened that maybe that might be something he would consider moving his headquarters. He has not decided to do that yet. This is part of a plan that they had going forward to build their Cybertruck, which is an electric truck. They're also going to build models 3 and Y for the eastern portion of the United States. And they're going to build their Tesla semi-truck initiative, 18-wheeler type trucks going forward.
Why did he choose this particular spot east of Austin? It doesn't look like, I mean, to the naked eye, like a place where you might build a high-tech factory.
Actually, if you look at his pattern, he kind of picks these types of, the company picks these types of places. These are fairly undeveloped area of Travis County, one of the last areas of Travis County where you can find this much land outside of the purview of the city of Austin. That's one less layer of regulation that they have to go through. He is going to take over what was a concrete mine. And they are going to put this $1 billion factory out there.
You wrote that he's even been highlighting the ecology of the area. What's with that?
Tesla's 2,000 acres that they're acquiring is on the north bank of the Colorado River. And what they plan on doing is putting together some sort of public-private area where you can bring your family and walk along the Colorado River and you know, jog or bike. And I keep saying he because it's hard to separate the company from the CEO here. It's, you know, the county and the school district there are getting into an agreement with a CEO who is kind of leads with his emotions at times. You know, there's he's prone to tweet. He's prone to put himself out there way ahead of the rest of his multi-million dollar company. And at times that gets him into trouble.
So tell us a little bit more about these numbers. How many jobs and what about these incentive packages? Pretty sizable for at least the school district that he won a pretty large concession from.
They are promising 5,000 jobs full time. Once the plant is fully operational, 2023 or so. With that comes not just those jobs. There are contractor jobs. Anybody that's been near an auto plant like the Toyota plant in San Antonio or the GMC plant in Arlington, they know that there are a lot of contracting companies, contract work that will provide, you know, thousands of other jobs in addition to that, not just parts suppliers, but also, you know, food vendors and whatnot. So in exchange for that, those number of jobs, the school district is going to give $50 million in property tax abatements, meaning they do not have to pay that. And the county is going to give $14 million in a rebate over 10 years, assuming Tesla meets all of its criteria. Now, the school district still wins to a degree. It's a net benefit. The school district will make $28 million in property tax revenue. The concrete plant that is sitting on there now will only pay roughly $500,000 in property tax revenue over the next 10 years.
Any pushback from the community?
They are for this, from what I can tell from all the community meetings and whatnot. They are excited about the prospects. They are thinking this is going to be a transformative developmental thing for the area. You know, shops, this is a bit of a food desert in the county. There's no grocery store nearby. They have to drive 20 minutes to go to an HEB or whatever. So they're thinking that this could be a transformative thing for that portion of the county.
KUT Austin's Jimmy Moss has been following the news of Tesla's just announced plans to build a new gigafactory east of the capital city. Jimmy, thanks again.
Thank you.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Raise Your Hand Texas, working to strengthen public education for all students. More information at raiseyourhandtexas.org. The future of Texas is in our public schools. Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Tech University's online school program, TTU K-12, offering fully online courses for kindergarten through 12th grade to start anytime from anywhere. Learn more by searching TTU K-12.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Johnny Cash is a country music icon, that's for sure. His life has been well explored over the years. The 2005 film Walk the Line focused primarily on his relationship with fellow icon June Carter, but doesn't focus as much on Cash's first wife and the mother of his four daughters. This person was Vivian Liberto. She was a Texan, born and raised around San Antonio. She gets her story told in a new documentary called My Darling Vivian. It was first set to premiere at the South by Southwest Film Festival, but of course COVID-19 had other plans. It's now getting a theatrical showing of sorts in the form of a virtual cinema that's basically streaming, bought through your local theater. Matt Riddlehoover directed this film, and he joins us now. Matt, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you so much for having me.
I've got to hear a little bit more about this concept of virtual cinema before we go much further. How exactly have you worked this out for showings?
You know, it's a really new thing, very outside the box, but, you know, it helps supports all of the independent theaters across the country that, you know, their doors are closed at this time. So essentially, theaters that book the film have a page on their website and a link to purchase an e-ticket. And that takes you to a page that we provide for the theater specifically, where their patrons can rent the film and specifically support that theater.
This is really an interesting idea. And I think a lot of people are going to be excited to check it out, too, because the story of Vivian Liberto is fascinating. She was not as famous as Johnny Cash's second wife. Why did you find her story interesting to tell?
My mother-in-law is Kathy Cash Tittle, Vivian and John's second eldest daughter. So I had heard stories about Vivian over the years that, you know, weren't quite matching up with what I had seen in the 2005 film Walk the Line, because I think, like most of the general public, I took that as the peek behind the curtain, and that's what was and what happened. And when I was hearing about my mother-in-law's upbringing and about her mother, none of it seemed to pair with the narrative in that film. A friend suggested that I do this, and it seemed like a big responsibility to take on a project like this where so much of it is saying, hey, you know, everything you thought you knew is only half of the truth or just downright myth.
So was it more an attempt to set the record straight or just tell a story that a lot of people just have never heard, or maybe a little bit of both, perhaps?
Oh, absolutely. Both. And, you know, I knew it was important for this family and to have their four daughters' involvement, because with the exception of Roseanne, who has had a very public life herself, Cindy, Kathy, and Tara have stayed out of the public eye, much like their mother, and much like their mother have been written out of the narrative. It was just important to also show how the marketing machine kind of skewed history a little bit.
What part of that story has the popular narrative, for lack of a better term, gotten wrong about Vivian Liberto?
Oh, my goodness. First and foremost, you know, John was the love of her life. And she loved him until her dying day. She was incredibly supportive of John. And that's something you don't see in the very few portrayals of her that existed before this film. You know, very supportive, but just incredibly ill-equipped to deal with substance abuse and the long absences. You know, we're talking about a Catholic schoolgirl from San Antonio who met this handsome Air Force cadet at a roller skating rink, and then he gets stationed in Germany, and they write these, you know, thousands of love letters that she saved her entire life over the course of 3 years. And as soon as he returns, they get married and they start a family. And then it just so happens that, like, that happened to be her dream. And within, you know, blink of an eye, his dream to become a music superstar also came true. And, you know, she didn't know how to handle what came along with that. And it wasn't that she wasn't supportive. And so that's kind of just been passed down.
Could you give us an example of something that she had to take on when she was with Johnny Cash?
First, quick sidebar. It's also quite a slap in the face that the film Walk the Line is titled Walk the Line, because the truth of the matter is that song, his first number one hit, was written for her. As a devotion of his love, and that he would remain true to her. Mm-hmm. So that's just one thing that's just kind of just been glossed over or kind of muddied or fogged.
But it's a huge thing. It's a huge part of music history.
Yeah. Oh, for sure. So that's just to give you just one little glimpse. You know, by 1961, they had four kids, and they had been living in Los Angeles in a very nice community in Johnny Carson's old house, actually. And for whatever reason, John moved the family to Casita Springs, California, very small town, built a house on top of a hill that was populated with rattlesnakes and bobcats. And after years of essentially being up in this isolated locale with four young girls, John is off on the road with his band and with June Carter. In 1965, he's arrested for bringing pills across the border. And now this incident is portrayed in the film Walk the Line, but in real life, Vivian goes to the courthouse to be with him and to walk out of the courthouse with him, which in the film, it's a very iconic shot of him walking out, being photographed, and he's alone. But in actuality, she walks out with him. A photograph is taken that is then circulated through racist newspapers. And before you know it, there are rumors spread, because of course she's very exotic looking. She was of Italian descent, dark complexion, dark hair. Rumors spread that she's black. And on top of John's shows being canceled left and right as a result of this, because of course this is also 1965, her family and friends are made to write letters asserting that she is in fact Caucasian, then she starts receiving threats from the KKK.
You mentioned, you say that Vivian loved Johnny all her life. How was she able to move forward after the two separated?
Oh, wow. I think her incredible amount of just strength and will to survive, you know, the 6, 7, 8 years she spent on that house on the hill, very small town, you know, locals from the town that he'd meet at the bars would come up to the house in the middle of the night hoping to meet him when he was, you know, off on tour. So she was having to deal with this kind of thing. Wow. That really took a toll on her mental health, so much so that, you know, when she later moved to Ventura, California, Roseanne tells the tale of how her, you know, and this is before modern alarm systems, her house, the indoor, outdoor, just lined with bells so that she would know when someone was coming up the driveway or walked through the front door or went into the laundry room or opened the dishwasher, those kind of things. But, you know, she was a survivor, and more so, she was a tremendous mother, and it was all for her girls, and she just had to move on with her life and be strong for them, I think.
You think there are lessons here about how we treat and tell the stories of famous people?
Oh, absolutely. You know, it's the whole thing is a little disheartening because, You know, there's this element of kingmaking to it. And there's this, like I said previously, this element of the marketing machine, and whatever narrative is easiest to sell or looks best for your product, which in this case is a couple that perform together. I think for sure.
Matt Riddlehoover directed the documentary My Darling Vivian about Johnny Cash's first wife, Vivian Liberto of San Antonio. It's streaming now through local independent theaters. We'll have more at texasstandard.org. Matt, thanks again.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
I keep the ends out for the tie that binds. Because you're mine, I walk the line. Because you're mine, I walk the line.
I'm Jody Edgerton with Typewriter Rodeo. We create custom poems on vintage typewriters. You give us a word, a phrase, anything you like, and we create a poem for you on the spot. Cabin fever. We've pruned our shrubs so they look like people. We've trained our chickens to dance. We've cut up strips of old t-shirts, woven hopeful messages into our fence. We've taught ourselves to bake loaves of bread, sourdough challah, hamburger buns. We've ripped the labels off our spices. What a challenge! That was not cinnamon. We're doing okay overall, I think. Though the cat somehow has a shaved back. We're embracing art. The dog's the Mona Lisa. And I'm a masterpiece by Jackson Pollock. Who knows how long we'll be like this? Hopefully not many more months. But regardless, I think we're feeling it. The birth of the super weird COVID Renaissance. I'm Jody Edgerton with Typewriter Rodeo, and you're listening to Texas Standard.
Support for the Typewriter Rodeo comes from Texas Children's Hospital, focused on outcomes and care, and providing treatment to kids in the Lone Star State and beyond for more than 60 years. Texas Children's Hospital, personalized care for every child. More at texaschildrens.org.
The Typewriter Rodeo is on air each Friday right here on The Standard, and it's always available via podcast. We're taking poem requests on social media and over at texasstandard@kut.org. That's email. Each Friday, we explore the week that was in Texas politics with the Texas Tribune. And joining us today is Patrick Svitek, political correspondent for the Tribune. Patrick, welcome back to The Standard.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And happy weekend. Well, at the start of this week, we heard news from the state GOP convention held online this year. But there was a shakeup in leadership making a lot of headlines. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, in an early morning vote on Monday morning, the incumbent chairman of the state party, James Dickey, was beat by his challenger, Alan West, who is the former Florida congressman who moved to Texas several years ago and has become politically active here. And it wasn't even really a close race. The way this thing works, the delegates first vote in their Senate district caucuses, and West ended up carrying such a strong majority of those caucuses that Dickey withdrew from the race essentially and decided not to take it to the floor to have a vote among all the delegates of the convention. So it was a pretty resounding defeat, and it sets the party on a new path leadership-wise with just a few months to go until a pretty important November election for Texas Republicans.
How was West able to do this? I mean, he had a somewhat higher than usual profile as a congressman from Florida. He sort of became something of a conservative firebrand, right?
Right. I mean, there were a few factors working, I think, in his favor heading into this vote. He, as you pointed out, definitely had a high profile, is pretty well known nationally to Republican activists, especially the kind of Republican activists that would be like the delegates to a state convention like this. He also was very well funded as a candidate and was able to raise and spend a level of money that we don't typically see in a state party chair race. And then, as you know, this convention, this virtual convention, ended up being pretty disastrous. And there were, many technical problems, a lot of delays, and that all happened on Dickey's watch. And so I think that, you know, a lot of the delegates, that was maybe what pushed them over the edge in wanting to support a change in leadership.
Also, the state's top court, the Texas Supreme Court, will be getting a new justice. Paul Green, a Republican who served for 15 years on the bench, high bench, is retiring at the end of August. What happens now?
Yeah, Justice Green announced he's retiring at the end of August, which means that Governor Abbott will get to appoint his successor. The timeline is really critical here. If he had decided to or does retire, several days earlier in August, then this would be a vacancy that would be filled in the November election, and the voters of Texas would have a say on who his replacement is versus Governor Abbott. The Texas Democratic Party has asked Justice Green to move up that retirement date so that there could be an election to fill his seat. He has said he's not going to do that, and that politics is not influencing this decision, or at least the timing of the decision to retire. And so there's been a little bit of a political discussion over that retirement and the exact timing of it.
More on these stories over at texastribune.org. Patrick Svitek is politics reporter there. Patrick, have a great weekend.
Thanks so much.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Watching what Texans are talking about on this Friday, our social media editor, Wells Dunbar. Hello, Wells.
Howdy Friday. I said howdy Friday there, David,
I'll take
an indication of how this week is going. Yes, it is Friday for those of y'all paying attention at home. And we're hearing from our friends and listeners about their plans for the weekend, many going to be keeping an eye on developing Tropical Storm Hannah, as we heard earlier in the show. Interesting comment here from Laquette Manley on her Facebook page. She says, all the crazy things going on, but I'm also looking forward to putting my feet up, petting the dog, and drinking a cold beer from a local brewery. However, Wendy Rohan in the mentions there, she notes that it'll have to be a to-go beer only. She adds that she's so upset that they won't let people sit outside and have a drink. And she's referring here to, sort of a new change that's cropped up this week. The headline at the San Antonio Current says it all. They wrote that the TABC, Texas Alcoholic Beverage Commission, reverses decision letting Texas breweries reopen their patios, and brewers are PO'd, using stronger language there. Basically what happened here, the TABC that reversed this change that would have allowed local breweries to pour beers to be consumed on-site, outside, did an about-face about like 5 or so days after they announced that breweries could indeed pour their beers for people on-site. So the sort of back and forth really, ticking off a lot of Texas brewers who had planned to boost their bottom lines during this pandemic and help their business out by being able to serve those drinks on site. So interesting thing that has really resonated with fans of that stuff. Laquette Manley, she goes on to say, this revised rule seems arbitrary. We can eat inside a restaurant, go to a gym, but we can't sit outside and drink a local beer. So obviously has some fans of those breweries quite upset online there.
A few of those fans, yeah.
Yeah, definitely so. Here in Texas, home to so many breweries. Just one of the stories we're keeping an eye on again, watching for what will happen with the potential tropical storm Tropical Storm Hannah once it makes landfall. Hearing from folks about other stories on the show, that great take we heard from our Michael Marks about the push to try and get those Friday night lights back up there. Mm-hmm. Once schools reopen, someone tweeting to us that we want to get back to normal so badly, however, we won't really be able to do that until this pandemic goes away.
We're out of time for the broadcast, but the news continues over at texasstandard.org. Joy Diaz will be joining you once again on Monday in the host chair. And, of course, we hope you will have a wonderful weekend.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Waldridge, Adrian Killam, and the George Huntington Family. Would your company or organization like to be a sponsor as well? Contact your local station for opportunities within your community. For statewide sponsorships, visit texaspublicmedianetwork.com.